So I'm late, so I know it, so I'm sorry. But you're not sorry you're listening to the Dare Daniel Podcast, a.k.a. the Scare Daniel Podcast, where you send us your most sinister movie dares, and we suffer the consequences for your amusement. I'm Corky McDonald, local comedian, and as serial killer James Veneman once said, it's the smiles that keep us going. And with me, as always, is film critic Daniel Barnes.
Hello, everybody. During this month of October, we do your dirty, scary work by watching the most unwatchable scary movies you can imagine, and then we review and rate them using our unique system. Run-of-the-mill bad film, we'll rate it a dare. We give the double dare rating to those truly atrocious movies, and we reserve the reverse dare for those despised movies that are actually pretty good.
Today on the podcast, we're reviewing George C. Scott in William Peter Blatty's 1990 horror threequel, The Exorcist III. This dare came to us from Christopher Reeves. Now, I know what you're thinking. We've made the mistake ourselves. We do get some dares from the wormhole, sometimes from characters in movies, sometimes from actors. This is not a wormhole dare.
No, this is not ex-Superman Christopher Reeves.
Nope.
This is Christopher Reeves.
Christopher Reeves.
Fan of the show who sent this in 100 years ago.
Yeah.
This is a dusty one. We dusted this one off. It had like fake cobwebs and everything on it.
This dare is older than the demons referenced in The Exorcist. Christopher Reeves' dare goes like this. Compared to Exorcist 2, this movie is The Godfather, but still has enough in it to make you ask, what the hell is that and why? Plus, it's got George C. Scott at his shouty best giving everyone crap. Mental hospital shenanigans, creepy old people, and invisible radios are just a few of the joys you'll discover. And the best reason of all, no locusts.
Ooh, sold.
The IMDb synopsis for Exorcist 3. A police lieutenant uncovers more than he bargained for as his investigation of a series of murders, which have all the hallmarks of the deceased Gemini serial killer, leads him to question the patience of a psychiatric ward.
Yes, this week's film is The Exorcist 3, no colon in the title. Yeah, Christopher kind of referenced it, but longtime fans of the podcast will remember that we reviewed Exorcist 2, colon, The Heretic, back in October 2018 for our first edition of Scare Daniel. We're bringing it full circle here.
Hey!
That was episode 25. That's almost 100 episodes ago.
Jesus. At this point.
That much maligned sequel brought back Linda Blair from The Exorcist, but it did not involve director William Friedkin. He made the successful and very influential film, The Exorcist, or William Peter Blatty, who wrote the 1971 novel and won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for the film. Exorcist 3, on the other hand, is written and directed by William Peter Blatty, the original author of The Exorcist. It's one of the two movies he directed in his illustrious literary and cinematic career. Not surprisingly, it completely ignores the events of Exorcist II, The Heretic. And I think that was a good call. I would love to completely ignore everything about Exorcist
II. All it's done is join the rest of us who live our lives day to day, completely ignoring that Exorcist II ever existed.
Right, yes. None of that. None of it's there. The Exorcist III, Friedkin and Blatty originally developed this project together in the early 80s. Friedkin was attached to direct. When he left the project, Blatty instead wrote it as a novel called Legion. It became a big hit. And he eventually got to direct the film, which stars George C. Scott, Ed Flanders, and Brad Dourif. Scott plays Lieutenant William F. Kinderman, the character played by Lee J. Cobb in the 73 film, if you're only familiar with that one. Ed Flanders plays Father Dyer, the character played by real-life priest Father William O'Malley in the original. Morgan Creek executives forced Blatty to shoot a new ending at the last minute because they said, hey, It's The Exorcist 3, but there's no exorcism sequence. And by the way, William Peter Blatty never wanted the title The Exorcist 3, especially after Exorcist 2 tanked so much. I think he originally wanted to call it Exorcist : Legion, which would have been
much better.
Many people feel this weakened the movie. We'll talk about it for sure. The film, exorcism sequence and all, was released. There were many reshoots, I should add. It was heavily reshoot. I mean, there was a whole new character was added to the movie.
Holy fuck, yes, you can tell.
It is so uncomfortably wedged in there, but we'll get to it. It was released August 17, 1990, opened number one at the box office. All right. Handily beating that week's other major opener, My Blue Heaven, the film with Steve Martin and Rick Moranis. Mid-August, kind of typically, you know, I mean, all bets are off now in this crazy post-pandemic world of box office prognosticating. Mid-August is technically a dead zone.
That's your
dump.
You
can open at number one and not be a hit.
Yep.
And this movie was, not really a hit. Gross $26 million domestic, $39 million worldwide against an $11 million budget. So basically, it's a single. It's a single that just kind of just went up the middle there. He just was like, Broken Bat single is what this movie was.
It like, rounded, you know? First like it actually had a chance, but everybody's like, come on, you know you're not going anywhere.
Come on, what are you doing?
He's going to lazily throw it in from the outfield and you will still stay there.
No, be happy with your single. 59 on Rotten Tomatoes, audience score of 56, so not that disconnect that we're seeing from Hocus Pocus. 48 on Metacritic. Not terrible, but not, as the kids say, fresh. It's not widely beloved, a la Hocus Pocus, but it has attracted a loyal following over the years. Reading comments on Letterboxd, it has a really strong following. There's a lot of people who really love this movie, watch it over and over again. So again, it's not mainstream like Hocus Pocus, but we're kind of riding a similar vein of a movie that just came out, did what it did, was generally ignored. Again, it's coming out in mid-August. This is like, you know, it's a horror movie coming out in mid-August, so it's not even seasonally really hitting the mark. But again, it's come back. It has a following. A.A. Dowd of the AV Club wrote that the ending forced on Blatty by the studio was, quote, easily the weakest aspect of the movie, but that's mainly because everything that comes before it is so hauntingly understated. Kim Newman of Empire Magazine dissented. He gave it a negative review. He wrote, quote, the plot is a house of cards that constantly collapses. Corky, The Exorcist. William Friedkin's film, widely regarded as successful.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, yeah, people agree, people disagree. The general consensus, it's a very successful film. Huge hit at the box office. It was nominated for Best Picture. It's influential.
Indelibly people memorable still decades it. Later.
Absolutely. It's still a touch point. The Exorcist 2, widely regarded as terrible. Tanked at the box office. Nominated for Razzies. Highly forgotten, where the other one is highly remembered. The Exorcist 3, widely regarded as somewhere in the middle there, okay? Those are super polarizing from like one of the best of all time in the genre to one of the worst of all time in any genre, which I don't think it was the worst, but whatever. Where do you place The Exorcist? First of all, do you agree that it's somewhere in the middle? And do you place it closer to The Exorcist? Or do you place it closer to The Exorcist 2, The Heretic?
I see what you're saying. I think it's definitely in the middle. It's not as good as The Exorcist. It's not as bad as Exorcist 2. I definitely would put it closer to The Exorcist in that I liked it.
Yeah.
I thought this was a good movie, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe going out on a limb here, but I think it's probably the best movie we've reviewed on this podcast. 122 in. And I'm not known for being hyperbolic.
Whoa, hang on.
I save my reverse dares for classically good undiscovered films like Bright, like The Dark Tower, like Suburbicon.
Movies we'll never forget for the rest of our lives.
Just cultural touchstones. Just the things that are going to hang in the Louvre in 100 years. Yeah, so I liked this movie and I thought it was good. Kim Newman, I mean, I want to say, come on, man. What are you thinking? The plot is a house of cards that constantly collapses. That's overstating it. That's not what it is. The plot is just fine. Yes, it's a little hard. It's not linear and it's a little hard to catch on. You got to figure out what's going on, but that's fine. It does not collapse. But I think that maybe I'm giving away too much here, but I don't think that the ending made it suffer that much. I was perfectly, the thing that I thought made it suffer was obviously didn't have much money behind it. And if it would have been William Peter Blatty, who knows how to write a screenplay, if it would have been him and Friedkin directing his work, would have been, I think it would have been a hit, a, like an indelible hit.
Yeah, I'm on the side of saying it flies off the rails in the third act. And, you know, I can blame the studios or whatever, or I can exonerate Blatty. But I, at the end of the day, I can only review the movie that I'm watching.
Sure.
Not the movie I haven't seen or the one that doesn't exist. But boy, Father Mourning, the Deus Ex Exorcist, was the crock of all fucking crocks. And again, that's not even the fault of Nicole Williamson, who's fine. But it's so clunky how he is set up to fill that void in this movie of a white-haired man who's going to come in and make everything okay. It's the Max von Sydow role all over again. However, I sort of agree more with A.A. Dowd in that it's disappointing because what comes before it is completely the opposite of this movie, right? Like, I love that this movie, it's not satisfying in a traditional horror manner, but it's really unsettling.
Yeah.
It's very ambitious. It's actually really well made. There's so many great ideas. They're generally well executed.
I agree.
This isn't a hocus pocus. I get why this movie found a really loyal audience. It's creepy, it's weird, it's arty, and it's not gory.
No.
Okay. Well, like it doesn't fit that obvious mold. Until it does.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and that's what is really, it's disappointing.
I didn't have a problem with that, though. I actually kind of dug it that they went it dialed the crazy up and up and up. And then finally, when we get that character, who you're right, was obviously the shoehorned in studio rewrites character, reshoots, they gave him the most grotesque death and punishment.
Sure.
And I was like, that's fucking awesome. I'm okay with that. If it had been just kind of like, he comes in and he deals with it. No, they gave him the horrific, you know, pain.
It's pretty
bloody, brutal.
Yeah.
It was unique. I had never seen a death like that in a horror movie.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. I think it portrayed kind of what comes before, which is this really slow creep, which and that is like totally kind of the opposite of what The Exorcist is, which like ends up being really vulgar and grisly.
Yep.
And it's not that until, again, it just is that, you know, and it's because the studio said like, again, I can only review the movie that's there.
No.
But it just feels like all of a sudden it just goes off the rails. And I can say it actually maybe goes off the rails in a very long sequence that comes before that. But again, we'll maybe get to that.
One thing I want to say about the original Exorcist was some of the creepiest parts to me were not anything that had to do with Regan being possessed. It was the medical procedures because they were so cold and sterile, and the way they were filmed, it was almost Kubrickian.
Yeah.
This had that kind of aspect again in its very methodically paced and subtle and subdued. No music. Some of the scariest aspects don't even deal with anything that's scary. It's just the interactions and the setting and the tone.
In the words of Exorcist 2: The Heretic, let's synchronize our tones. And I'll be in your thoughts, you'll be in my thoughts, it'll be fine.
Sure, and I'll be over here trying to put out a fire with a crutch. That is my favorite part of Exorcist 2, when Richard Burton tries to beat a fire out with a crutch.
That's right.
Not how fire works.
And that's obviously, you know, stage fire, because the vodka vapors coming off of him in every scene would have just, the whole set would have combusted. Okay, well, let's get into Exorcist 3. Georgetown, 1990. That's where we're at. We're back in Georgetown.
Hey,
okay.
This is
rowers on the river. We see an old priest. It's Father Dyer. And we see, you know, the Exorcist steps, what is widely known as the Exorcist steps.
Father Dyer looks at the steps and has a little bit of ennui.
Right. He's thinking about Father Karras from The Exorcist, who took the spirit, you know, spoiler alerts for a movie that came out literally a half century ago.
I don't think there's anybody listening to a review of Exorcist 3 who is not familiar with the plot of The Exorcist. And if you are, I love the way you live your life.
Yeah, but just to remind you, Father Karras, Father Damian Karras, he takes the spirit possessing the character played by Linda Blair into his body and then basically commits suicide. He leaps out the window to his death. He falls down the Exorcist steps, these really like kind of weird, creepy steps outside their Georgetown apartment, and to his death.
Yes.
right? And Father Dyer comes over and administers the last rites, all right? Different characters that played. Although Father Karras is played by the same guy. He's still played by Jason Miller.
Yeah.
So,
and well, again, by the way.
Spoiler alerts for this movie. So George C. Scott, all right, so Father Dyer is kind of, you know, wistful about Father Karras and his death. George C. Scott, he's Lieutenant Kinnerman, also a little wistful about Father Karras. Mm-hmm. He's working alone at his desk. He picks up a picture of Father Damien Karras, and he says, Damien. And then we get the nee-noo-noo-noo-noo-noo-noo-noo-noo-noo-noo. So the Mike Oldfield Tubular Bells theme from The Exorcist. And overall, we're just getting this, like, ominous feeling.
Yes.
Like, we don't know what the hell is
you're jumping around,
like,
but everybody's got something going on inside their head.
So then we get to this empty church at night, and the doors just, like, blow open, and Jesus's eyes, the statue of Jesus's eyes, like, shoot open. It's this, like, really, it's cartoonish, but it's very arresting. There's some sort of supernatural force at work here. We don't know what. Something's happening.
Right.
Okay. Title sequence, right? Now, this is where this movie, it just, like, the way it moves from scene to scene, now there's just this, like, kind of tracking shot. It's like your slasher POV shot where it's kind of, it's just sort of lurching around a little bit. It's on the street. We see these figures running back and forth. We see a little kid on the street with something that says police on it.
Right. You get this shot of the sun, and it's like a setting sun in a haze, and then there's three helicopters flying in front of it, and with a narrator, and that shot, is, I was just like, Saigon. Shit, I'm still only in Saigon. I was like, wait, does this movie jump back to Vietnam?
Totally, yes. I mean, but that's sort of like the impressionistic feel that is going on, is that Apocalypse Now kind of feel. I mean, this isn't, I mean, you know, personal feeling. William Peter Blatty's not like a director on the level of a Coppola or a Friedkin, but he's doing a really nice
job.
Here. Like, it's very well crafted, I will say. And this is a good scene here. So we see these three helicopters. We're like, what the like, where are these? Like, it's just like, what is happening right now? But it's they're over the river. They're looking for something, and then there's police. They're investigating a dead body. This is cut with a priest who is giving, like, who's giving rites. You know, he's doing, like, priest, you know, whatever, priest business. And then all of a sudden, holy shit, young Kevin Corrigan.
I know.
He was like, I didn't recognize him by his face, but his weird pauses
I've never seen him this preppy and clean. Like,
oh my God, it's so weird. It's so weird. He's like an altar boy or something, but he's just like the assistant to Father Dyer, right? So who then has this, like, flashback to Father Karras' death, this really graphic, like, falling down the stairs kind of sequence, you know?
Yeah.
And we find out he's going to go see, he's going to, him and Kinderman are friends, right? So the priest and the cop are buddies. This is a friendship that does not, like, if you've just seen The Exorcist, it's not really fleshed out.
Right, right.
It's only really fleshed out a little more in the director's cut, because it's, like, at the very end, in the, it's called, like, the version you weren't meant to see, or the something like that. It's fleshed out with, like, there's a scene after where the movie has ended, where the theatrical cut ended, where they kind of become better friends. This is maybe why I was a little slow to kind of pick up on the dynamics of this relationship between Kinderman and Dyer, which I was a little kind of baffled by.
I didn't get
first,
that Kinderman was from the first movie.
Yeah, but it is kind of a funny relationship. I mean, they're these very grumpy old men. Like, they have this really, like, gruff banter with each other, right? Where they're always kind of, like, insulting each other in this weird sort of, like, passive-aggressive sort of way.
Yeah,
it's just really funny. It's really, really funny. So they're buddies. So they're going to go watch It's a Wonderful Life, and each one thinks that it's because they're cheering the other one up, right? It's like, this is how miserable these people are. They're just like, I don't know which one of us is the depressed one. Who fucking knows? So we cut to Kinderman kind of talking to the police, and he is sort of tying this dead body that that was found in the river to the Gemini killer.
Right.
Right? Okay, so he's obviously supposed to be modeled after the Zodiac killer. Right, which was already, like, a thing in, like, Dirty Harry, where they had a thing, you know. So, like, this is well-worn territory, right? But, okay, so nothing new. But we eventually find out the Gemini, everyone's like, he's dead. He was executed, we eventually find out, okay? But they meet at the movie theater, and there's this, they go out to dinner, and there's this whole thing about the carp.
Yes, so This is where I felt like they're really, it's really claustrophobic. Like, yeah. This scene, especially, they're close proximity to the camera, but then you've got walls behind them that kind of screen, but not really the restaurant behind them. And so everything's just forced into this little tiny area, and everybody's pained. Everybody has pathos. Everything they talk about, there's a problem. There's something going on. There's something under not being said. And we get this story, horrific story. All of his dialogue at the beginning, George C. Scott's dialogue at the beginning, is horrific. And he just tells the worst story of a killer killing a kid. And then goes on to tell the worst story of why he can't go home because his mother-in-law is cooking a carp. And somehow the story about eating carp is worse than the story about the headless tortured child. It is so horrible. I mean, the priest would have been like, fuck, I quit. There is no God. You're right. God has left us.
There are some crazy ass fucking cameos in this movie. Larry King is at this restaurant. All right. Larry King. It's New York. Larry King will appear. It's Washington. Yes. And Larry King will appear in anything.
Yeah, right.
Larry King's not like, wait, hang on. I mean, did he just see a script? I mean, he's just like, Larry King, be in anything. He's like, okay, yeah. Great, let's do it.
We also had John Thompson earlier, just shot from outside a window, walking through the Georgetown campus.
How about C. Everett Koop?
What? I did not know that.
C. Everett Koop, the former Surgeon General of the United States, is in this fucking restaurant in Georgetown. It's insane.
Holy shit.
Crazy. Crazy stuff. So now we cut to another priest who is played by Harry Carey Jr., a veteran of many a great John Ford Western. We see this kind of old woman walking into the church. There's a voice in the confessional, and it's very similar to the voice of Pazuzu in The Exorcist, which was Mercedes McCambridge, who, like Lee J. Cobb and Father William O'Malley, was not alive anymore, 17 years later when they made this movie. So it's Colleen Dewhurst, who was twice married to George C. Scott, although not at this time. Whatever, just fun trivia there. But they married and divorced two times.
I love that George C. Scott was probably like, okay, you need the voice of Satan, right? Okay, yes. Call my
ex-wife.
My ex-wife. No, it'll work, trust me.
So this voice talks about, the sins. Can I be forgiven for my sins? And we don't see it. It's just this darkness, right? And it's very, creepy.
Very evocative. The more this claustrophobic, because we're getting the shot in the confessional booth through the screen at the priest. But the priest's point of view is just blackness. There's a void on the other side of that screen. Just, it's really well done.
It is. It really is. And this voice is talking about their sins, and they had 17 sins, and that we find, they were murders, right? And the problem was the blood. What do I do with all the blood? And the priest just has this horrible look, this horror-stricken look on his face. And then we just see these, kids, very, no reaction on their face, and then just a slowly creeping pool of blood through down the church.
And then a woman just hysterically, she must have been the one who found him, something like that. So this movie doesn't do the gore, the kills, it does the reactions. It does what the aftermath and what you're dealing with, and it's really good.
Yeah. It's all set up in aftermath, which to me is just more,
It's almost, it's creepier.
More sinister, yeah. And Kinderman's on the scene again. Kinderman is just like any murder. Kinderman.
His role, George C. Scott, it was just like people who write he's a cop. That means he's on every case. He works any hours he wants. He has all jurisdictional powers that he needs. he can wield his gun at any time.
Right. He could just walk into a private hospital and just do whatever.
Everybody's deference to him. He's the chief. At the same time, he's just a lieutenant.
Yeah, Kinderman's on the scene again at this the murder of the priest. We also find out that the boy who was murdered was injected with an electroshock drug, and that he was, again, this is more horror, likely awake while he was getting, mutilated by whoever did this heinous crime.
The way George C. Scott finds out that information about the succinylcholine that's been used on the bodies is delivered in the confessional booth by a cop speaking through the confessional window. I mean, that's still an active crime scene. I know you've already got the body out, but there's still so much evidence you are fucking with right there.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah, Dyer, now he's in the hospital. More great, really gruff banter with him and Kinderman. It's just this like kind of friendly hostility, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
I was going to say odd couple, but it's not really that. It's they're at each other, but they love each other.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's there's real like caring and real affection there. But, you know, at the same time, they're such men. They can't even, they can only come out as like hatred of each other in a weird way.
But you could say Kinderman loves Damien, Father Damien Karras, and Father Dyer more than he loves his wife.
Oh, no doubt about it.
Because he's definitely looking for any reason not to go home. And he's always spending time with these horrible, horrible stories.
No, seriously. There's also like a Spaceballs reference, I guess, because he says, may the Schwartz be with you, because he's going to see someone named Horowitz.
So was that after Spaceballs? That was after Spaceballs came out, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't know if it was in the Legion book or whatever. All right, so mystery, huh?
Yeah.
What? How are these murders? Are they connected? Are they not connected? Obviously, Kinderman thinks they're connected to the Gemini killer. He goes to sleep that night and has a super crazy dream sequence.
This was wild. This is when I was like, whoa, this movie like is slow, subdued, it's paced, there's no soundtrack, and then it goes bug fuck nuts.
Yeah, it is not playing by the rules at all. But bug fuck nuts, not in William Friedkin way,
no,
where like people are vomiting in your fucking face. Like
artsy.
An angel, yeah, right? This is some Vin Vendors shit right here. It's just like angels in a train station and it's a hospital. Fabio's there.
Yeah, it's a train station that's also a hospital that's also heaven. Heaven's waiting room. And there's angels sitting on beds with sick people who are, I mean, Fabio's there. Samuel L. Jackson's there.
Yep.
Patrick Ewing. Is
Patrick Ewing
is an angel is reading tarot? What is happening? There's also a big band playing.
Yeah, like it's pretty wild.
It's obviously a dream sequence without ever like you don't have to see somebody wake up and go like that. You know, it's just it's really I liked it. It's so well done. It's
quite clearly a dream sequence. Yeah. So he comes to Father Dyer, who is, again, doing the tarot with Patrick Ewing.
As you do.
Patrick Ewing, who played for Georgetown University.
Right, but and not, was a New York not at this time.
Not at this time. No, he was a Nick at this time. And Kinderman says to Dyer that they must be having the same dream, and he says, I'm not sleeping, I'm not having a dream. And when Kinderman is woken by a call, and of course Dyer was butchered to death at the hospital in his bed, and there are all these cups of some sort of a red liquid, and they are his blood.
It's not shown. It's just a series of cups really stackly neat, and it's just the cops talking about it. The body was drained completely of blood, not a drop spilt, not even any, you know, smudges on the jars. Somebody got all the blood out of the body except for, and they're like, what? Oh, what he wrote. It's like, it's just further, each little bit reveals just something grosser and grosser, or more unsettling and more unsettling.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And what's written on the wall, It's a Wonderful Life, which is the movie they went to see, except wonderful spelled with two L's. Yeah. Kinderman goes to the mental ward at this hospital, and he's hostile to everyone that he meets. But I mean, he was hostile coming in, but now his best friend just got butchered at this fucking hospital. So his hostility gets dialed up a notch, understandably so. But this dude was already at a fucking 11. So he has a very hostile questioning of the nurse. And then this old woman walks in, and she needs her radio fixed and asked if he's the radio repairman. She hears dead people talking on this radio, and she hands him the radio, which is invisible. And he takes it, but she says, it's a telephone I'm holding. So, all right. This is before we even get to the so-called disturbed ward. All right. We're just we're a level above the disturbed ward where it's just invisible radios. Okay. Yeah. So we go down to the disturbed ward, and we hear Bill.
Yeah.
Some mysterious voice saying Bill, so for William Kinderman. And there's a mysterious patient with their head down, and we don't know anything about him, so they leave. And then a different voice says, I was only 21 when I died. So, like, who the fuck are these voices? Who is this patient? We don't know. Kinderman goes up to talk to hospital administrator, and I mean he's at his very shouty best here.
Oh, good. Right? It's Scott Wilson. You know he's going to be a thoroughly upstanding character.
So
I don't think he's ever played a good guy.
Oh,
he's always slimy.
No. So Kinnerman he fills us in a little more on the Gemini Killer. He says that all the murders that have been happening, they have all these calling cards of the Gemini Killer, including some that weren't made public because they made public Mr. X to say, no, it wasn't on his left hand, it was his right hand.
Back information.
So that they could filter out, you know, people who were copycats or were fakers or attention seekers, okay? So even this stuff that wasn't made public, so it seems more and more like it's the work of the real Gemini Killer, who, again, was electrocuted and died.
Right.
You know, just so.
This part got on my radar just a scooch because of kind of like Silence of the Lambs. It's around the same time. It's when the serial killers, like, we understood a little bit more about serial killers through the work that was done to study them. But then everyone had to have like this gimmick or this like interesting take. And we find out like his thing was like leaving double L's or double letters on the last word he wrote. It's like, that's a very juvenile understanding of how serial killers operate their MO.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
That's nitpicking. That's just what they understood at the time or what was appealing at the time for stories.
Yeah. So there's just lots of strange things. Footsteps, creaky doors. This is like, again, this is like a movie. It's a slow burn kind of a movie.
Oh, and it's getting more each as it goes along. My opinion on this movie is it works best when George C. Scott is just reacting. Not when he's at the gruff shouting, but when he is taking the information in like we are. And it's like him reacting to other people is when this movie's at its best. And it gets more of that as it goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. So he goes to see like the head priest who could give like 1/100th of a fuck.
Right.
Like this guy is like knee deep in a cognac. Bottle, you know? Like he does not care, but he basically they figure out that like all of these deaths are somehow tied to the Regan McNeil exorcism. And there's talk of like, well, maybe you need a real exorcist. So how about this guy, Father Mourning?
Yeah.
Father Mourning. So this is the character who was invented for the reshoots of the movie. Again, extensive reshoots, more edit. This movie's like 110 minutes. Really feels like it should be more like Straight Jacket, like a tight 90.
Yeah,
you know, it gets a little bloated. So we go to Father Mourning's apartment. He's played by Nicole Williamson. Strange doings right away in Father Mourning's apartment. He is made up really to look like Max von Sydow. He's got the white hair. He's got some kind of a weird voice.
Yes.
Like he's doing some kind of a Max von Sydow without doing it. You know, he's just in that zone. But there's like a dead bird. A crucifix falls off the wall. The crucifix bleeding. There's just ominous signs. Okay, so remember this, I don't know, 45 minutes later when all of a sudden this guy is like the most important guy in the universe.
And what's crazy is like, so this guy's done an exorcism before. That's what turned his hair white.
Right.
That's why he's living secluded. He sees that crucifix fall off the wall and goes to get it. I've seen The First Exorcist. Don't be touching that crucifix. You're going to catch something. Get a sterile wipe. I'll pick it up. We don't know where that crucifix has been.
So you remember the radio woman, the invisible radio? Her prints were on the jars of blood, of Father Dyer's blood. No one can explain it. She can't explain it. She's very old. She's very frail. How is she going to drain this dude of his blood? That makes no sense. Then we see the doctor. He's sort of like the head doctor at this place. He is nervously pacing back and forth, chain smoking and practicing
lightness
a speech for Kinderman.
Like end to end.
Yes, like finishing one cigarette and then just starting the next cigarette off of like the butt of the other one, because God forbid you would have non-cigarette air in your lungs. But he even has a poster of the Hanged Man on his wall, which I was like, that's a dead giveaway, dude.
he's got a portrait of himself and the portrait of the Hanged Man. He's like, okay, you're not long for this movie. But he's chain smoking like Martin Short's character Nathan Thurm, like just like he's so weaselly and sweaty. Like,
so he's practicing the speech for Kinderman. He's taking notes, and then he gives the speech to Kinderman. And basically, he's saying that this man in isolation, you know, this patient X, he's claiming to be the Gemini Killer. They don't know who this guy is. At which point, Kinderman says, it's not in the file. It's not! Although in a way that is so high pitched that my voice, I would not be able to speak for a week if I did it. But he's just like,
it's not in the file. It's not.
It's like George C. Scott times Nick Nolte, the scream. It is amazing. He thinks that the patient is Father Karras. He's like, that's Father Karras. I don't know why he thinks that.
He kind of just makes that jump.
We're just there with it.
Father Karras, ironically, was the original title for Webster. I don't know how many people are going to even get that joke.
No, none, but I love it. I love it. So Kinderman goes into the cell to talk to Karras, Patient X, whoever you want to say, Gemini Killer, and this person who, again, we see him as Kinderman sees him.
Yes.
Which is as Father Karras, Jason Miller from the original film.
Not looking too good.
Not looking great, no. But I mean, you know, he's been dead for 17 years, so
I could cut him some slack. Worse.
I'm gonna get like, okay, you fell off your skin routine. That's fine.
He's not a.
I get it.
What's it with Billy Bone Shatter or whatever from Hocus Pocus? I mean,
he's looking about like that. Yeah, Doug Jones should be playing him in some motion capture ping pong.
But Jason Miller crushes this. I thought he did really well.
No, he did fine. He says that he's behind the killing. So we're seeing him as Father Karras. And he says the last three were on behalf of, well, a friend. He makes this demonic roar. I mean, something real supernatural shit is happening here. He says I've been taught by the master. And in this kind of very, you know, neat little sort of sensate sort of a camera move, we now see him as Brad Dourif.
Yes.
Who is the Gemini Killer, who is inhabiting the body of Father Karras, right? So this is Brad Dourif from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which I think we mentioned last week, from the Lord of the Rings films. You know, you always know him as
Deadwood.
The wide-eyed, really fucking crazy. Yeah, Doctor in Deadwood. Yeah. A very distinctive character.
Billy
actor.
Bibbit, yeah. He's going for it here. I liked him. I liked him a lot.
It's a fine performance, yes. Absolutely. But Kinderman still sees him as Karras. But now we're seeing... as Brad Dourif, the Gemini Killer. And he's very gleefully describing his crimes in a very like disgusting sort of a way. Kinderman slaps him, but he's just completely unfazed by it. But then he just grows tired and passes out.
Yeah.
Like he goes down. The nurse lets us know that this patient's brainwave activity actually accelerates when his body is catatonic. What? How's that? See, okay. I have a few issues with the film.
Okay.
Here's one of the issues.
Sure.
This mystery is as easy to figure out as Straitjacket, because it's like once we get into the hospital, it's like, who the fuck else could it be, man? Like you've narrowed it down so much that there's no possibility for like for a red herring.
Yeah.
For us to follow a false lead. Okay. Like. It really, by the end of Act One, is pretty obvious what's going on here. I would even say, one third to one half of the way through, I figured it out, and I never figure shit out in movies where there's supposed to be a mystery. And then in this movie, it's done as like a police procedural where there sort of is supposed to be a mystery about like what the hell's happening. Halfway through, I knew what the fuck was happening.
Okay, I didn't take it that way. I didn't take it that it was supposed to be a police procedural or mystery, except for Kinderman, because he's a detective. He wants to solve these things. It was like obvious to us, even just seeing The Exorcist on the title kind of tips it like what is happening. But for him,
right.
He's coming into this like, wait, how does this even work? How is this even possible? We know how that's possible, but it would make no sense to him that would be the thought that you would jump to there. Even though he did know that was Father Karras somehow. It would make no sense.
And he knows about the exorcism. I mean, he knows about the exorcism because he, whatever.
Well, yeah, he just knows fine. It's something. He still thinks he died just falling down the stairs.
Sure. Fair enough. So serve your servant.
Yeah.
So that's something that somebody says this leads him to rites for exorcism. So we're like, obviously, okay, we're locating it. We go back to the hospital, and this is probably the most famous / beloved scene from this movie, and it's pretty great. I gotta say, I'm gonna go. This is an all timer.
Is this
type
is
of
this the
sequence.
Hospital shot?
This is the hospital.
This is so fucking
sequence.
Good.
Oh, it's fantastic.
See, I had never
so
heard of this
is
movie.
A real.
This is like known.
Oh, this is amongst fans of the film. This is like the scene.
Okay, because I was like, this is fucking great.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. Again, it's this real slow creep sequence. The finale of it is bloodless. It's not, you know, shocking slash disgusting a la Friedkin. It's just like it takes a long time for it to kind of play out, but it's pretty fantastically done. It's this real slow build kind of a thing. So it's late at night. The nurse is alone in the hospital. Obviously, there have already been, you know, several murders connected to this hospital, like
right.
Sleep hospital, and everything's fine. This security, there's a nurse there alone, a young nurse. There's a security guard who just kind of keeps coming in and out.
Yes.
Right? So there's these strange noises, these little kind of skittering noises,
no
these
music.
Little skittering. What's happening? The nurse walks into one of the patient's rooms. She hears this noise. And there's a, I mean, this is how brilliant the sequence is. There's a jump scare effective over melting ice.
Yeah.
Ice melting right. in a thing of ice water. So there's just like, bum, and it's just ice melting in there. But then all of a sudden, a patient jumps up and is shouting at this nurse, as patients
sure.
do in hospitals. Yeah. Healthcare workers are just treated like garbage. It's a shame, and it's got to stop, but it won't stop in this movie. We're still going, right? So shouting patient, okay, oof, jump scare, we're relieved, we're settled down again, everything's fine, okay. Now, the actual kill is done in one long shot. Okay, so this goes on for like a minute or two.
Yeah.
It's just this one long shot of this hospital corridor. We see the reception desk. There's a little bit of obscurity.
Camera does not move. It's just
no.
down the hall. All the action is from far away. And
yeah.
it's that unsettling people coming in and out of doors, coming across off camera.
You know, like
you don't know who's going to get it, how they're going to get it, but somebody's going to
yeah.
get it.
But there's just some kind of a dread there. And she seems to relax. She doesn't notice that the security guard, you know, has been pulled away. He's pulled out of the room. And it's kind of great because she seems to be heading into a place where it's like, that's not safe for you to be there. She heads the opposite way, seemingly to a safe off-screen space. And then that's when the killer
yeah.
strikes her from behind yeah. with a pair of surgical shears that we have already seen, you know, heard can just like cut right through somebody.
Right.
But no blood.
No blood.
We just see the boom, but there's a shot cut to a headless statue.
Fucking
right?
A,
so
man.
We get it all in there. It's pretty fantastic.
I rewound it
it's
like
pretty
three
fantastic.
Times. I was like, how did they do this? Oh, okay, that's how they did it. But then just the pacing of it, it was so good. So
yeah,
fucking
it's good. It's the way they kind of build tension, relieve it, and then have this sort of dread where you're not really sure. They're not really trying to build or relieve
right.
tension, and then all that's when it strikes
and
out.
And
you know?
I really appreciate it. I've brought it up several times, the absence of music, because it really just made it kind of like you're focusing on what visually is happening, and there's nothing tipping. This is how you're supposed to feel. It's just like you're going to feel whatever you're going to feel about this, and we're going to make it all visual.
Yeah. Guess who's back on the scene? Kinderman.
Hey.
What are his hours?
There are no like, other cops.
I'm doing 168 hours this week. My overtime is fantastic.
I would love to see the first 48 that followed the Washington Metro Police Department Homicide Squad, where it's just Kinderman like blocking the anybody else getting a call.
So again, grisly details. We don't see it. But we hear just grisly details. The nurse's vital organs were removed. Her body was filled with rosaries and sewn back up. The doctor, who is also found dead. However, we just see it's not a grisly death.
No.
He's just slumped at his desk and there's a hypodermic needle next to him. So it's an apparent suicide. So now it's another tete-a-tete between Kinderman and Karis slash the Gemini Killer. And the hospital corridor sequence, I think, is widely appreciated and rightly so. This is, I think, a sequence that's probably a little more polarizing amongst people. The Gemini Killer, he monologues for about 10 minutes explaining everything.
Yeah.
Like, this is where I think the movie kind of goes wrong. This, obviously, in Father Morning, I think it kind of goes wrong. I think it goes a little off balance with the Gemini Killer. It doesn't find that right balance with him. Brad Dourif, all the credit in the world, he is keeping this thing afloat, but this scene kind of grows tedious. And it's, I think, because we needed either more of the Gemini Killer's backstory, his motives. There's this kind of vague thing about his father. It's never really pays off. So we either needed a little more for all of this monologuing to pay off, or they needed to really trim down this monologue and let more of it just be a mystery.
Uh-huh.
As you know, like, it's a mystery. How the fuck did a demon enter this little girl in Georgetown?
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? Like, it's not explained, really. I mean, we get a little about Pazuzu and about Father Marin.
We see
Marin
something dug up at the beginning, and then it's like, okay,
right.
you just assume that has something to do with it.
But then we're just shooting a movie yep. with Ellen Burstyn and Jason Miller. You know, like, it's... yeah. Anyway, I think that it's a little off here. But he... the Gemini Killer slash Father Karras just monologues and monologues and monologues, and it kind of explains it all. And the explanation is that all of this is demonic payback for Regan O'Neill.
Yes.
Right? It's all these demons were just pissed the fuck off that they couldn't, like, inhabit this girl and bring about, like, whatever they were trying to bring about. So now they're torturing Father Karras. Somehow, like, the Gemini Killer was executed at the same time.
Right. It doesn't.
That Father Karras died and Pazuzu merged them somehow.
Yeah. They tried to marry a little bit of, like, science and
yeah.
religion kind of stuff. Father Karras has been dead for now 15 years, and it took him right. that long to rebuild the cells in his brain to function.
Yes, he's just been catatonic yeah. this entire time.
Right.
Yeah, he's been living, he's been in this disturbed ward for, like, a really long time, but he's just been catatonic trying to, like, rebuild and rebuild.
The part that I couldn't make sense of. See, I didn't have a problem with it. I was just in for the ride, enjoying, like, what the performances and what was happening. The part I didn't really, like, get was why he was so adamant that he had to tell the press that it was the Gemini Killer back. Like, right. he just threatened him, like, you have to tell. Like, what was the end game of that? Was it to say, you know, make him look like a fool because he's talking about a dead killer's on the loose again? Or is it to say, like, no, demons are here? And
just because that's the MO of the Gemini. I mean, supposedly, like, the Gemini Killer, he did it to shame his dad because his dad was really religious, but he was actually super abusive, yeah. piece of shit. And so he does this to shame his dad. And I think that's, like, the tie-in to, like, being in the press. And also, I don't know, just the tie-in to the Zodiac Killer, like, writing into the San Francisco Chronicle and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So the Gemini's want is still, like, notoriety. That wasn't
still
the demon
same.
Part.
Yeah.
The demon part is
no, yeah. Okay. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, even the Gemini Killer seems, like, slightly unsure of why all of this is happening,
yeah.
or who's pulling the strings and why they're doing it. But you
and
know,
they,
he's
they kind of hint sometimes that he actually comes through more than the demons and is almost polite or something. Or is that Father Karras?
Yeah, Father Karras also will poke yeah. through occasionally. That's why he said Bill.
Right.
You know, when.
Well, the nurse says that sometimes he says things in a voice where he's, like, almost, like, soothing and comforting. And
right.
That's Father
yeah,
Karras.
Yeah, that's Father Karras. Yeah. So anyway, this monologue keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. We learn more. We get more definite things. So the doctor really did kill himself. Because he was helping the Gemini Killer and he had, quote, other tasks in mind. He says, quote, old friends got him out of the cell. Again, he insists that Kinnerman tell the press. He says that they're torturing Father Karras because they're going to make him view, you know, all of these horrible killings that are happening. Blah, blah, on and on and on and on and on. I timed this. It literally goes on for 10
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah.
10 minutes of Brad Dourif just monologuing, like, all of this, like, plot information. I mean, it's just, like, this is where the movie kind of lost me a little bit. And it kind of keeps losing me as the third act kind of drags on. So Kinnerman, oh, so he passes out. This is, like, the thing that the Gemini Killer does, is that he comes to the surface, but then he passes
yeah.
out, right? And in this brief moment between where he really falls asleep is where Karras comes to the surface and says, Bill, help me, in Father Karras' voice. All right, upsetting. So Kinnerman, what you going to do? What you going to do when they come for you? So he's now walking amongst these old patients, and he's thinking, old friends, old friends. And there's a woman talking to a radio. It's like, God damn it, Kinnerman, figure it the fuck out. It's just like, I figured it out a half hour ago. And again, I'm not one of those people who figures out the twists to movies. I never figure that out. I can never do it. When I'm watching a movie the first time, that's what's so fucking, I mean, whatever. So there's a nice, pretty creepy scene, which again is a callback more to a scene from the director's cut, or the version you were never meant to see of The Exorcist, where there's like a spider walk by Linda Blair's character.
Yeah, I remember that.
And in this one, there's this old woman who is like walking on the ceiling like a bug. It's the old woman with the invisible radio.
I didn't see that part.
Really?
Yeah, I think
go back and watch it. It's fucking awesome.
I think I would have remembered that.
The old woman walking on the ceiling?
Yeah, I definitely would have remembered that.
Oh, go back and watch it.
Yeah, I missed that.
Go back and watch it. It's right after the big monologue scene. Yeah, she's just like suddenly, he doesn't see her. She's like right above his head and she's just like moving super fast.
Oh, no shit.
This like weird point of view shot where you can like see her looking down on him and she looks all crazy and shit. So yeah, she's climbing on the ceiling and then we just see this blood under the door. And then we see a patient, one of the catatonic patients wearing nurse clothes. There's a dead body, a naked dead body in the hospital, you know. So it's just like, again, these really unsettling things that keep happening. His wife, Kinderman's wife, take my wife, please. She gets a call about a nurse coming over.
From Bill. We hear his voice.
From Bill.
But the cut to Bill on the phone, he's got a busy tone.
Signal. Yeah. So, holy shit. So they race to his house in just this crazy... crazy car chase. It's not a car chase. It's just a car driving very, very fast. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's crazy.
It's
a French Connection kind of a thing, which is, you know.
But you can see George C. Scott's age in this because he's like, they're taking like mild right turns. He's like, he's grimacing.
But it is very French Connection, yes. Which is like a funny homage to Friedkin, where he's not chasing another car, you know, but he's just kind of chasing against time. So he gets to his house, bang on the door. Oh my God, what's going to happen?
Gun drawn.
His gun drawn on his daughter, who answers the door and is like, "Dad's here."
This like, is not the
this
first.
Not the first time. No, he's. This is like how he comes home. He's just like, "Honey," he's like knock on the door. Who the fuck are you? Oh, hi, sweetie. They're like, hey, we're fine. Everything's fine. But what's the deal with this crazy nurse?
In the reveal.
Wah, wah. And this old woman who we've seen, we've earlier saw her talking to a radio. She says, please help me. But then suddenly pulls out the same surgical shears and almost like by the whisker, yes. Almost decapitates Kinderman's
daughter. The
hated
mother-in-law is like, no one's ruined carp night and saves... Julie. But before she says, please help me in her voice, and then she starts speaking in Billy Bibbit's voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think is another one of those really creepy, evocative things. And it's just so simple. Like that scene where, you know, she's talking to him on the phone and then it cuts to him and he's hearing a busy signal. It's not explained any further than that, but you get the entire
gist.
Economical. I love it.
It's fantastic. So yeah, Gemini is now speaking through this old woman. She just seems to have like superhuman strength.
Yes.
She is just going the fuck off, but then suddenly, weakens.
Mm.
Why? Father Morning. Gasp. Dumb. So there's we get another voice. So I think this is the Colleen Dewhurst voice again, speaking from Karis's body. I must save my son. But Morning says, this time, you're going to lose.
How did he get in the hospital?
How did any of any? Yeah, this is the most shoehorned ass, like, we need an action sequence to close this movie. Oh, it lost me here. I got to say, I mean, there's nothing against, like, how it's shot or anything like that. But it's just like, it really just goes against everything
I was in for it. I guess
it just becomes a different movie. It becomes Friedkin's movie and not Blatty's movie.
Yeah. You're right. I didn't like that.
I mean, we get the cold breath. We get the visions. Yeah. Holy water. Like it's almost just like callbacks.
It may sound weird because it involves the same characters or a lot of the same characters, but without the title Exorcist on this, you could like, if you saw this, you would not may necessarily tie it to the other movie.
No, if it was just called Legion, you might not even fully make those comparisons
until this kind of stuff. But I will say I didn't mind it. And actually, I thought some of it was good.
Some of it's well executed, but I did mind it. Father Mourning is thrown to the ceiling. His flesh sticks to the ceiling. He rips apart. I mean, it's pretty fucking gory. They really just went for it. Kinderman enters to find Father Mourning seemingly dead.
Yeah.
But there's nothing deadlier than a New York City cop. Okay, because they shoot to kill.
DC, he's DC Metro.
DC, god damn it, whatever. Same fucking deal, cop with a gun.
Yeah, cop with a gun.
So, yeah, the devil voice, Kinderman is now trapped against the wall.
In a crucifix same kind of stance, arms akimbo.
Yes, and like, what do you believe in? You know, he believes in, you know, hate, evil,
right,
and murder.
You think he's
going
to go one
like
way.
He's seen so much. He's seen so much.
Definite jaded cop. Definite.
Yes.
I'm 2 days from my pension. I'm too old for this shit.
So holes now open up in the floor, and up comes a very disturbing image. It's the crucified boy with the black-face Jesus head.
And gets in his eyes.
We see Father Karras crucified on these rowing oars.
He says, "Oh, Billy," like Midnight Express.
And then the Pazuzu / devil / whoever it is voice says, "Save your prayers. God is not here with us now." Mm-hmm. But who stirs? The Deus Ex Exorcist, Father Mourning, calls out to Damien because he knows him. Does everybody know Father Damien?
Like, oh, that's right. He does.
So he urges him, fight to the surface, fight to the surface. Father Damien makes it to the surface. And he says, "Shoot now, kill me now." Yeah. Blam, 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 blam. And he says, "We won, Bill. Now free me." Blam.
Off screen. Just hear the shot.
And he's lowered into his burial plot. The end. Like, it ends just that fast.
Really, really fast.
It's like slow burn. And then all of a sudden, just like a fucking napalm, it's like explosion of a bird. It's just like, it's crazy. So that is your movie. Yeah, no, that's
it. That's it. It's
you thought
just
we were
done.
Just going to say, no, it's the movie's over. It's The Exorcist 3. Yep. Quirky, final thoughts before we give our ratings.
You know, Father Mourning was probably really familiar with Father Karras because if you're a priest who does exorcisms, that's your guy. That's like he's the A number one. You probably have his trading cards. You know what I mean? Like,
you have the Father Marinter. Yeah, I know. But going back to The Exorcist, Father Karras' whole thing was that he doesn't do exorcisms. He wasn't even really a man of faith. Like, his brother had died. He was losing his faith.
But he gave his life to do one. So
sure.
In their thing.
Oh, no. No, I get it. So he's like, all right, yeah, Lou Gehrig died of Lou Gehrig's disease. But, oh, man, wow, Lou Gehrig. I totally know Lou Gehrig. Right.
I mean, that's their terminology. Like, he Karras'd himself, you know? It's just like, that's how they talk about exorcisms.
Okay, so just to remind everybody of our rating system, run-of-the-mill bad film is a dare, next level bad, double dare, and a movie we actually like, reverse dare. Corky, what do you got for me? I know what you got.
Yeah.
You just said this is the best movie in the history of the show.
Yes, I do think that. I love the pacing. I loved its deliberateness. It was slow and methodical and claustrophobic and creepy and off-putting. You never knew where you were in this movie. You weren't comfortable. And then the moments it would kind of lull you in, whammo, the next scene would be just like, what's happening? What? But then it tied it up. And I liked the way it ratcheted towards the end. I know storytelling-wise, Slipshod, it kind of falls apart with, you know, the structure of it. It's not a house of cards that falls apart, though, like that one reviewer says. But I think for me, the performances overweighted that. And then the whole thing, the exorcism being in the cell to me was cool when hell opened up, when the floor went, mm-hmm. And then it's the more of the visuals If it was just like light shining through, or if it was just like the fake lightning, that would have been crap. But what they chose to use, and it was pretty evocative. The like I said, George C. Scott reacting to it was really good as a surrogate for the audience, and it helped with that. I thought everybody crushed it in their performances. So yeah, man, I was in for the ride the whole way. I dug it from start to finish.
Sounds like a reverse.
Bell, big time reverse there. Big time. The small reversest time of dares for me.
Whoa. So reversed. It almost reversed itself. Small time reverse dare for me. Okay. I liked it. I appreciate it. It's definitely one of the better, well-crafted films that we've ever reviewed on this podcast. That said, it all didn't kind of gel for me at the end. It's not a movie that's designed to be satisfying.
No.
So, I mean, I'm fine with being unsatisfied. But again, I think there were just some real miscalculations in terms of tone and storytelling, as you alluded to, and how we're developing the characters. There was a little too much, or there wasn't enough. You know, small criticisms, but enough for me to say this is not a masterpiece. It's not something I'm going to revisit over and over and over again. But I absolutely appreciate the hospital corridor sequence is fantastic. There's a few other sequences that are really brilliantly put together. The murder of the priest, that sequence is great. George C. Scott's really good. We didn't really even talk about how much he screams at people
in
this movie. We alluded to it, but like, there's so many scenes where he just like suddenly just screams. And I mean, George C. Scott is known for screaming. I mean, if you've ever seen like Paul Schrader's Hardcore, there's a really famous scene of him watching something and it's off screen and we're just seeing his reaction, and his reaction is just like, turn it off, turn it off. And he's at that level throughout almost this entire movie. So it's pretty, that's pretty great too. Again, had some issues, but it's a reverse dare.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. So that's two reverse dares.
It's something I would watch again. And I would also like watch with people to be like, yeah, have you seen this? If you want to watch a scary movie, let's watch this
one. Like turn somebody on.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe certain things will play better the second time around. Maybe it won't seem so jarring. Maybe I will. I definitely feel like the father Dyer Kinderman relationship was one that I was like, it was a few scenes into their dynamic before I really kind of understood what the hell that was going
fucking
on with these two.
Exactly. I was like, I can't tell what are jokes and what's not, you know, like I can't get this. Oh my God. That was one of the things I was going to say. It took me a while to get the pace of it, but then I got it.
And again, it's because that's not really, it's not like an established relationship really from The Exorcist. If you're a big fan of The Exorcist, you're not like, oh yeah, that inimitable like friendship between those two. You would like, but it's in the director's cut. I think it's in the book a little bit more. It's probably fleshed out a lot more in Legion, the novel as well. But yeah, it was an interesting kind of part of the movie that I think I was a little slow to come around on. So anyway, two reverse stares for The Exorcist 3. That doesn't happen that often.
No.
Although, did we both give reverse stairs to Straitjacket too?
We did to Straitjacket, yeah. So that's two this month.
Holy moly, what's going on?
Thank you for the dare, Christopher Reeve, if you're still a listener from way back.
Yeah, sorry it took us several years to get to this dare, but you know, we only do Scare Daniel once a year.
All right, that's all we have for you on this episode of Scare Daniel, but we'll be back in 2 weeks to kick off Travoltember by reviewing one of your John Travolta movie dares.
Until then, send your movie dares to us at daredaniel.com and be sure to follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Like and rate us on all them podcast apps. If you want to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com and click the donate button. Find the sports show in the menu, Corky.
Yeah.
What are you doing, man? You're out there on the streets of Georgetown, which is in New York. I don't want to hear this whole Georgetown's in Washington, D.C. bullshit it's the liberal press. They'll sell you anything. What are you doing on the streets of New York?
I'm not doing much these days because it's going to take about 15 years for my brain cells to come back together from being complete mush.
Oh. No, I get that. I get that.
And all of us in here, all of us inside in here, we're just gonna bide our times, probably play canasta, just do puzzles, something like that. We got 15 years to kill.
Yeah,
no, but seriously, you can see me Saturdays, Fridays at the Sacramento Comedy Spot, J&20 the Sacramento. Have fun, take classes, see shows.
Good call for Daniel. I'm Daniel Barnes.
And I'm Corcoran McDonald saying it's just a bunch of peas and anchovies. That's something said by a character in this movie.
Awesome.
See you guys.
Bye.